Thank you, Joe, and thank you for the chance to speak to you all today. The title, Joe wanted a title, so I gave him something that I thought was generic, because the theme of these this extended workshop and of the conference that you had was nanoscience. So I thought I should include that in. I'll talk about, the title generically talks about nanoscience and photonics and what new opportunities there'll be, but actually what I'm going to talk about is fairly focused, and that is on a particular nanostructure, the interaction of quantum dots within micro and nano resonators. The two resonators that I'm going to be highlighting in particular are shown here, and you see by the long list of collaborators here that this is an extended effort that depends on many talents and many inputs. These lines give the support, the general support of the research that I'm going to talk about. But before I talk about that, something that Joe has wanted me to do, I think, since the beginning of this program, is particularly for those of you who have are not familiar to our campus, to talk about maybe some of the opportunities existing on campus that you might avail yourselves of in terms of the general work that's going on primarily, and I've highlighted primarily the experimental areas because I think you well know what's going on in theory. This is, as I said, a very coarse overview and certainly incomplete and unlikely to have left out important programs. I hope my omissions are not too grievous. So what I've tried to do, and I'll try to run through this very quickly, to indicate loosely organizations that carry out certain kinds of research that are very relevant to nanoscience and nanotechnology, where I can and where it seems logical to identify a key person that you may want to contact. That's not possible in all cases because the list of people is much too large. First of all, there is IQEST, which stands for Institute for Quantum Engineering Science and Technology. I put it as a confederation. In fact, it is a confederation. It is something on this campus that's called an organized research unit, which means that it has an official existence, a recognized existence on this campus. Basically, the important thing for you to know that it is a group of faculty and students who come from various diverse departments, all the areas of the College of Engineering. People from the College of Engineering, physics, chemistry, computer science, materials, and hopefully in future years the breadth of departments and expertise will expand still further. Part of IQEST are some small centers within IQEST, this organized research unit, and two which may be of particular interest to you is Center for Terahertz Science and Technology. Much of that research is focused around the availability of our free electron laser on campus. Mark Sherwin in the physics department heads that. Then there's a Center for Quantum Computation and Spintronics, and there are extensive programs, research programs in that. David Auschlum, who's already spoken here, is guiding that effort. There's a materials research laboratory, which is right next door to you. This is an officially funded multidisciplinary effort, and it's funded by National Science Foundation. Tony Cheatham is the director of the MRL. Although I don't like to stereotype or capsulize efforts too much, basically, I would say that the work of the MRL, it's outstanding strengths are related to biomaterials, so-called soft materials, and the issue with biomaterials for nanoscience, as many of you probably know, is to be able to manipulate on the molecular scale through chemical means, chemical and biological affinities, so-called self-assembled structures. You're going to see some another example of self-assembled structures of different kind later on in my talk. There's the chemistry of so-called inorganic materials such as zeolites. These are cage-like structures. Again, this is, many of you may know this already, these are cage-like structures that have natural and periodic periodic symmetry, where the openings in the cages can be controlled to be anywhere from angstroms to tens or hundreds of angstroms. And also, this kind of research that goes on in these areas also take place separately, not necessarily through the MRL, but separately through departments of chemistry, physics, chemical engineering, and so on. There are programs in micro and nano electromechanical structures. These include a wide variety of topics, ranging from microfluidics and single electron, single spin detection devices. Michael Rukis was here earlier on. There is some work in that area being done here, most notably in terms of the single electron, single spin devices by Andrew Cleland in physics, and there's another program going, extensive program going on in what are called more traditional MEMS structures, utilizing mechanical properties of materials, largely maybe at the micro rather than nanoscale, and these take place in mechanical engineering, and there's a growing program in that area. There have been here at UCSB for a long time, this is something that was established, actually the founder of the program is Herb Kroemer, initially at the sort of beginning of the building of these programs, programs in high-speed electronic and optoelectronic devices. And the reason I mention this in the context of a program in nanoscience is not so much because you necessarily are interested in the high-speed aspects, but generally in many of these programs, high speed and higher performance has also meant scaling down to nanoscale. And there are a variety of fundamental physics issues that come along with that. In particular, our programs have focused on compound semiconductors, and most recently we've established excellence in this material called gallium nitride. Now, David Auchinleck mentioned this briefly. Many of you may not know gallium nitride. I'll come back to this again. I mention it because it's a material, although that in many ways may be ideally suited at some point for nanoscience studies. There is a new program funded by Mitsubishi Chemical. It's called the Mitsubishi Center for Advanced Materials. The director of that program is Glenn Fredrickson. Again, this is largely soft materials, but also it's a program that is interested in exploring the interface between organic and inorganic, and that's a very loose phrase, but generally some of the interesting aspects of that is to look for compatibilities between so-called biological materials, whether they're polymers that we usually find biological systems, or they're actually materials such as DNA or proteins. That compatibility with materials that, such as semiconductors and metallic materials, and the interest there is to be able to harness some of the power of biological systems in being able to control inorganic nanostructures. There are new programs being set up in bioengineering, most notably under the leadership of Allison Butler and also Matt Terrell, who's our Dean of Engineering. And then lastly, I want to talk a little bit about the newest program it is the newest program in this panoply of programs dealing with nanoscience, and that's the California Nanosystems Institute. What that is, it represents a new vision and a major investment by the state of California under happier times, both economically and politically. It was a program that was set forth by Governor Gray Davis about 2 years ago now. The idea is to look ahead to the major science and technology issues that we'll face, that we should embrace in the 21st century. And in particular, since this is a state-funded initiative, in particular how those issues relate ultimately to our economic well-being. The program makes investments. Originally it was $100 million from the state for each, for three California Institutes of Science and Innovation. It is now four. That money is to be provided over 4 years, and it's not to carry out research, it's to provide the funds to build the infrastructure that will enable that research to take place. In order to qualify for those funds, each successful proposal needed to show that it was able to raise $2 to every $1 provided by the state. So our institute therefore had to show evidence that we had the possibility of producing essentially $200 million in non-state funds. The reasoning behind these institutes is shown here. They have to do with stimulating scientific innovation, coupling that innovation with the state campuses, so coupling education and research innovation, enhancing collaborations between universities and private industry. And again, this program ultimately has the goal of having some benefit to the economy. Our California Nanosystems Institute represents a collaboration between our campus and UCLA. The announcement of the successful institutes was made December of last year, and the institute director is Martha Krebs, who previously served as the director of basic energy sciences in the Department of Energy. And Jim Heath plays a coordinating role on the UCLA campus, and I'm that counterpart here at UCSB. I'm going to go through very briefly, just to give you some images to be associated with the kinds of work that we propose to carry out. And the images, I'll show you the images that we proposed, as we develop, I think the avenues that we go down will be very different. And so the first images I show you will represent some of the strengths of both the UCLA and UCSB campus. Then I will switch to some of the activities on our campus in particular, and use that as the entry point for getting back to nanoscience and photonics. UCLA's medical school is involved in this. There are clear applications of nanoscience and technology in the medical field. And I show you this just to represent that some of the issues involved are to develop new optical imaging technologies with sensitivities at the molecular level and spatial resolution higher than we have now. The ability to do, this piece of equipment is equipment that allows you to carry out positron emission tomography, PET. It's a way of doing medical diagnosis of soft tissues. And one of the issues for molecular imaging is to be able to get a clear idea of what's going on with ever smaller samples. So increase the sensitivity, increase the spatial resolution of the imaging techniques. Nano electromechanical machines span a wide variety of applications, ranging from making, and again, I think those of you who were at Michael Rukes' talk saw some evidence of the capability if you make structures where there's very, very little mass in the resonated, mechanically resonant structure, you have the ability to do many things that we can't do now. For example, the resonant frequencies of those structures are in the gigahertz range, and there are a number of applications you can think of in that case. And also you have the possibility, the less mass the detector, the more sensitive the detector is to small, at the molecular level, to small increments in mass. On the other hand, for the microelectromechanical structures, here's an example of work done by Noel MacDonald, large-scale arrays of mirrors. These are actual switches. Those are the switches that may be used in this LCD projector, for example, to form a changing image on the screen. That and the fact that there's some fluctuation in my computer. And then I show also what's called, in the jargon, BioMEMS, activities carried out at UCLA. So the ability to bring together biological materials, whether it's DNA or blood cells or whatever, soft tissue, into an environment where you can electronically probe and monitor, but you also can confine and you can perhaps run the kinds of chemical analysis through microfluidic channels and separation that you would do at a macroscopic scale. Frontier information technologies, and this is a large part of this is an overwhelming strength here on our campus. I show you a sort of collage of different kinds of so-called frontier information technologies, quantum computation, and I know there's a program going on here at ITP, many of you you have an interest and a knowledge of it. Different ways of carrying out, different ways of realizing, in fact, quantum computation techniques. Photonics, I'm showing you a photonic band gap structure, and I'll return to this. Spintronics, this is what David Aushlam spoke about. Molecular electronics, this represents in schematic form the work that's being carried out within CNSI, primarily by Jim Heath at UCLA, which is actually using the finite, controllable, distinct states of molecules to carry out switching, where typically we've used much, much larger structures to do that. Part of the business of CNSI, and now I'm going to begin to focus more on activities that you'll see on this campus, is to carry out nanoscience, you need nanostructures. To make nanostructures, you need to start out with some way of forming building blocks and putting them together. A lot of the work that's going on, and you may know this very well, in the nanosciences have particularly focused on quantum dots. And largely for us, that's been in semiconductor systems. Quantum dots are basically structures that are confined in three dimensions. Typically, the sizes for these semiconductors are on the order of anywhere from 20 to 100 angstroms. The size is really related. There's no fixed size. The size is related to the difference in the behavior of the electrons, primarily the electrons and the photons that you see in these structures. There, I show you two ways of making them. These are the two principal ways. Here at UCSB, particularly Pierre Petrov has done some major seminal work in trying to form these three-dimensional structures out of largely a two-dimensional technique, molecular beam epitaxy, which has a capability of doing atomic accuracy layer by layer, but using the mechanical strain in the material to form three-dimensional structures with a high degree of perfection and a high degree of control over the structures. This is what happens when computers get old. The typical size is 300 angstroms. There is a dispersion in the size, which for many applications is something you want to avoid. In the applications I'll show you, actually, we take advantage of that. And in this case, what you've seen, what Pierre's done, is pre-patterned the substrate to define those areas where the quantum dots would prefer to nucleate. The other way that has been very successful is to just, rather than use this two-dimensional atom-by-atom technique, is to use chemical synthesis. Here's a transmission electron micrograph of a cadmium selenide quantum dot. That dot was actually synthesized by Paul Alvasados at UC Berkeley. In general, there's a little bit more flexibility in three dimensions in forming these dots. You have to be extremely talented chemically. You have the ability to cap your quantum dots in different ways, and that's important from the point of view of constructing superstructures based on the quantum dots, and also in being able to better control the quality of the electronic and optical response of these quantum dots. Spintronics, I'm not going to spend very much time over this. This is something that David Aschlem has talked about. The sole purpose for showing you this is a new information technology, spintronics, using the spin as well as the charge of an electron in order to convey information. What you see here is something that may look very familiar just in terms of pattern recognition, in terms of a magnetic response. It's we're actually measuring polarization. David's actually measuring polarization as a function of magnetic field, but this is a typical hysteretic curve. The point is that this is a spin polarized light emitting diode, where the gallium manganese arsenide has shown ferromagnetic behavior and is used as a source to inject a non-zero polarization of spins into conventional structure. The light emitted by the recombination of holes from the gallium manganese arsenide that are polarized, recombining with electrons from the gallium arsenide, if it shows a preferential polarization, that's an indication of a remnant of the initial polarization of the holes that went in, and this indicates that indeed there was that net polarization. Something that's very different, but I think will become more important to our studies as time goes on, is the work that's represented here, which is more and more the interfaces, and this is in many ways too trendy, but in many ways I think there's real substance and much potential in this area. So what I show here on the left-hand side is it's basically silica-related. It's the skeleton of a diatome, and it's shown here just to show you what we know very well, that in nature you find very many instances of structural perfection. On the right-hand side is something that Dan Morse has recently been working with, using a natural source, which are sponges, marine sponges. He's been able to pick out, these are silica needles, so he has been able to extract silicon-based structures of varying forms, which may be, these are natural nanostructures that may have a variety of uses, particularly if you can go back and engineer through genetic engineering, you can engineer the outcome. So by making a modification in the DNA of the sponge, the output is a modified structure in silica, which may have a preferred shape or orientation or whatever. I think here it's just on the order of 10 angstroms or so. I need to find out. And so they can be quite long, on the order of microns, but narrow, perhaps 10 angstroms or so. And I can find out more detail for you. Another activity that goes on in our campus, gallium nitride. What I'm showing you may look very macroscopic and have nothing at all to do with nanoscience, but there's a large activity going on here, and the reason I mention it is because it's a fascinating material. It's a material that at the moment is riddled with, it's an unconventional material that's riddled with a host of threading dislocations, but the typical important length scales in this material somehow are small enough so that defects that come once every defect densities of, let's say, 10 to the 10th per square centimeter seem not to affect the optical efficiency of these materials. So there's something that we can learn. It may be a natural nanostructure inherent in these materials, and there's something to be learned from these materials. I just want to point out very briefly that with the state funds and the state investment, there will be a new building, to David's everlasting chagrin. that will be here is where we are, and the site, and this is not what the building is going to look like, but the site is going to be over in that direction. In a few years, hopefully there will be new facilities that will have shared resources for a variety of researchers working in a host of different aspects of nanoscience and nanotechnology, shared imaging spectroscopy facilities, novel labs that allow us to mix biological and physical electrical engineering techniques in fabricating nanostructures. Incubator labs, lots of visitor offices, computation capabilities, and so on. It's perhaps a rather lengthy introduction. If you have any questions at all, following up any of the programs that I've hinted at, or you want to know other particular people to get in touch with, please let me know. I'd be more than happy to make that connection. And so now I'll turn from the general description to one of the areas of nanoscience that we're pursuing. In particular, Atoch in the background has been a major force in all the activities that I'm going to describe to you. So the title of my talk was Nanoscience and Photonics, and I'm not going to talk in general about nanoscience and photonics. There are many ramifications there, but what I want to talk in particular about is one particular manifestation, and that is, suppose that we have a emitter, whether it's an atom or whatever, it'll turn out to be a quantum dot in our case. We have an emitter that, in the simplified way that we like to handle nature, has two states, a ground state and an excited state. And when the electron, let's say these are electronic states, when the electron makes the transition from the excited to the ground state, it emits a photon. That photon then goes out into the broad world, and the broad world has a number of possible modes or available photon states for that photon to make the transition to. Now, Purcell noticed in 1946 that the terms are very imprecise. This is the environment, this is the emitter. By changing the environment, by changing the nature of the optical environment in which we emit the photon, we can modify fundamental properties such as spontaneous emission rate. Purcell, and just to give some perhaps visual portrayal of this, to follow on with these thoughts, if we have an emitter, let's look at if we were to plot the spectrum of the emitter and of the modes. So here's an emitter, and in general, optical emitters, whether we use semiconductors, some lasers, have a certain breadth to it. They have a certain breadth in frequency. They're on the order, if you do spectroscopy, on the order of millielectron volts wide. So the emission is over not a delta function, not a discrete frequency, but generally over a range of frequencies. And similarly, the environment into which we send that photon generally consists of optical modes, which are fairly broad and which actually may look almost like a continuum, and where there's perhaps a strong overlap. So we emit over a breadth of frequency, and the photon then gets absorbed or occupies a mode where, in fact, we may not be able to clearly identify or certainly recapture the pathway of the emission from the electron to the optical mode. If, however, we could change that, and here's where the nanoscience comes in, because there's not necessarily anything intrinsic to all this. Suppose we had the following. Suppose we had emitters that, in fact, gave very sharp emission spectra, basically something that look like delta functions. And suppose that they were to emit into an environment where the optical modes were more finely tuned, that is, more narrow, and clearly distinct from each other. Then we have, under these cases, we have a situation where we now can potentially selectively couple the output of an emitter with a particular mode of the cavity or the resonator. In certain situations where we can engineer that very precisely, it's something called the strong coupling regime, where in fact what that means is that there's a single wave function that can describe the emitter coupled to the cavity, to the mode. And there are various implications of this strong coupling regime. Now, much of this, including the observations by Purcell, have been realized for a long time in atomic systems. And one question is, can this selective coupling of an emission output to a resonant mode be done in the solid state? And here's where we come in. If we have the appropriate signature from an emitter, and we can tailor the cavity of the resonator in the proper way, then this may be possible even in the solid state. Now, as we go on, and I talk to you further about how we do realize this. What we essentially need is to find emitters with that narrow emission spectrum, that delta function. We need to place them strategically with respect to the environment that we embed them in the resonator, so that there's a coincidence not only of the frequency of the emitter and the resonant mode, but there's a spatial coincidence, so that the emitter is basically an antinode or a maximum of the mode of the cavity. And in trying to achieve this, we look for a rough figure of merit. And I go through this because I'm going to show you two different kinds of resonators in the same emitter. They're going to be very different, but if we can evaluate them by the same bases, basically for the cavity, we want it to be lossless, that is, as we send in a photon into the cavity. Lossless means not that we cannot detect any photons coming out, but basically that it resides in that cavity for substantial amount of time. Narrow mode widths, therefore, is something we call high Q. And we also, another important property is with those modes, ideally we would like, and this is another aspect making things small, making the resonator small, is to limit the number of modes that are allowed in our resonator so that we have the full transfer of the signal from our emitter into the resonator. And therefore, a figure of merit is roughly, would be directly proportional to the Q, the quality factor of the resonator, and proportional to the modal volume. And that is given by the wavelength of the emitter over the index of refraction of the resonator divided by the volume, the modal volume of the resonator. So we're going to look at that as I look at two different kinds of resonators. The emitters we use to give the signature that we want are so-called quantum dots. I showed you this before. These are so-called self-assembled quantum dots. It's the use of strain of two materials, indium arsenide and gallium arsenide, which don't have a natural sim-identical lattice constant. And because of that, we can engineer these kinds of structures. You see here an AFM trace of a typical growth of our self-assembled quantum dots, and you'll notice immediately that they're not placed in at a regular periodic fashion. You can't, perhaps you cannot see so clearly, but there is a dispersion in size. So there is, we don't have control over the placement of the quantum dots, nor do we have absolute control over the placement of size. And because of that, the spectrum that you wind up with, a photoluminescent spectrum is the one shown here on the upper right, where the peak to your left is representative of the gallium arsenide substrate material. The broad peak to the right of that is the emission signature of the quantum dots. It's a very broad peak. It's 65 milli-electron volts wide. And that's an indication of the dispersion in size of these quantum dots. If you can focus on a single quantum dot, as has been done here in Itachi's group, if you can see the exciton transition from a single quantum dot, you see that the spectrum narrows up considerably, and with a 70 microelectron volt width. So, yes?
How do you focus on a single one?
You basically change the density of, we have a certain ability to change the density of the quantum dots. So that's one handle. And the second thing is that we can, so therefore you can make quantum dots that are separated by a micron or 10 microns on either side. You can isolate them structurally so that you're looking at a particular structure that also serves to, so you form a microdisk where you think there's only one or a few quantum dots, and then there are sort of micro PL techniques so that you can focus further.
But these dots, they are like random places. You cannot control them.
Right, and in fact, that works to our advantage, as you'll see. In these initial experiments, we really benefited from that.
But can you be sure that you're looking at one dot? The single dot, if, say, the average spacing is only 1 micron, so the order of...
You hunt. You made a number of structures, you make an array of structures, and you hunt. You look for a signal. The resonator, the first resonator I'm going to talk to you about is a micron-sized structure, not a nanoscale structure. It's basically this mushroom-shaped structure here. And as you can see from the schematic, the quantum dots are embedded in this part, this top part of the disk. So basically all the action shows, you can see in the schematic, and there's an indication of how the structure is made. And what we look for here is, with this kind of structure, is so-called whispering gallery modes. Low modal volumes, in some way you can think that these whispering gallery modes are formed by total internal reflection. So the capture and the low-loss capture recirculation of the optical signal within the top hat of the disk, coupling with the quantum dots that are embedded in that disk. So we have our first set of emitters, which are the quantum dots. We've embedded them in a resonator where we are looking at the modes that are set up in these resonators. Typically we've worked with diameters from anywhere from 2 microns to 6 microns. And what is the optical interaction of the dots embedded in that resonator? It's shown here. This is a photoluminescence spectrum, and what is shown is, in red, this is the broad spectrum of the quantum dots, as grown. So before we embed them in any external structure, you see what I showed you before, which is the typical very broad spectrum that reflects the dispersion in size of the quantum dots. What you see in the black, and again in the inset, is the spectrum that you obtain when you embed those quantum dots in. This is a 4.5 micron diameter disk. And this is taken at low temperature. And what you see is very, very dramatic and very obvious, which is that if you look here, the emission spectrum has now given discrete emission peaks with quite narrow widths, and you can see how narrow a little bit better in the inset here. And in a sense, what this shows here is that the coincidence, both spatial and in frequency, of the modes that exist in the Whispering Gallery disk with the emission, the broad emission spectrum, the quantum dots, in a sense filters or selects out particular peaks. Now, the Q, we're looking for Q, that's, we would like the Q to be as high as possible. Basically, one way of evaluating the Q is to look at the half width of the peak divided by the, or delta lambda over lambda, delta F over F. In this case, we have about 17,000. It's an impressive value, and it's probably to some extent limited by the instrumentation. If you increase the excitation power coupled into the disk, you see this nonlinear response in intensity. There are, as you saw from the spectrum I just showed you, there are a number of peaks that are selected out. And so,
if these peaks is representing specific quantum dots that happen to have those excitons?
Yes.
And they just agree with some modes of the microgravity.
Right. I'll try and show this pictorially later on. Yeah.
So, in this resonant, there are also several quantum dots. Are those the same quantum dots?
No. In this case, they're probably several thousand.
So, the comparison between the human genes is
very valid. Right. Yes.
Where is this particular mode? It's so well isolated from above. Why it doesn't include into above?
Oh, because that's the structure. That's why we have the post to decouple it from the substrate. So, just to go back, these were some of the results that we got with the microdisk. And again, to remind you, we have the emitters, we have now a micron-sized structure, and how we wanted to go from there, again, remembering our figure of merit. We're looking at the Q value, but we're also looking at the modal volume. And one way to try and decrease the modal volume, to make a resonator reliably that would have a smaller modal volume, is to go along the following direction, which is to make a so-called photonic band gap structure. A photonic band gap structure, its name suggests very rightly, is largely a periodic structure where there's a periodic variation in the index of refraction. And there can be different kinds of symmetry. This is a triangular lattice. There are different kinds of ways that you can position the lattice. The idea is, by using that periodic variation index of refraction, what you create, in analogy to what happens to the periodic variation of the electron potential in the crystalline structure, is this kind of band structure where there is a region where there's a band gap. That is, because of coherent Bragg scattering, there's no penetration of the optical signal of a particular frequency through the structure. So this is the simulation of the band gap for this kind of structure. This is gallium arsenide, holes etched into gallium arsenide. There's some details about the thickness and the diameters of the hole and the spacing between the holes. The important thing to note is that if you, obviously what I show here is not periodic. There is a glaring aperiodicity about it, and that is one of the holes has not been etched through. And in the jargon of photonic bandgap structures, we call that a defect, because that's a non-periodicity. In the same way that a defect in an electronic structure, in a crystalline structure, often serves to introduce an energy state in the band structure where none previously existed, this photonic defect can serve to introduce an energy state, if you want, mid-gap. And what that means is it's possible to localize the photon, if the the optical signal within that the confines of that defect. So in a sense, this serves as a resonator. This is a way to localize the optical signal. Now, just to give you some details, again, the idea is that we embed the emitters in the resonator structure. We actually form a membrane structure, so here are the quantum dots. Here is the pattern of holes and in gallium arsenide. This is what it looks like top down, and this is a little bit of a closer view. And if we look at our first results for the spectrum here, and I'll try to accelerate to finish up more quickly. Again, we notice the same kinds of features. The light blue is the broad spectrum of quantum dot emission for the quantum dots within that structure. Once we embed it into a structure, I'll tell you what H5 means in a minute. Once we embed it in this now a nano resonator, we select out particular peaks represented by the broad range of quantum dot emission available. This is one of our first measurements, and we got a Q that was quite respectable for these kinds of structure, about 1,400 over 1,000, which was quite respectable. One advantage of being able to make resonators in this way is that we have a tremendous capability to change the symmetry, to change the variation of the modulation of the indices, and to change the volume of the resonator. So the nomenclature, the last structure I showed you was so-called H5. The nomenclature is if you remove one hole, if you have a one-hole defect, it's called H1. If you take out this plus the surrounding, the nearest neighbors, that's H2, H3, and so forth. And basically, it's a way of controllably making larger size resonators, keeping the sort of lattice constant A, the distance between the holes, the same, or you can change the lattice constants as shown here. So you have a tremendous flexibility as both a diagnostic, a probe, and a way to control the interactions of the photons with the resonator. So for example, I show you here, these are three different samples. This is the H2 structure. These are the spectra that we see. Now, there's both good and bad news. Herb. Yes. It's about 1,000 angstroms, 1,200 angstroms. Yes. Now, I'm showing you the measurements, the spectra obtained from something that's nominally the same. The space in between the holes in all these cases is 255 nanometers. These are all H2 structures, so nominally they should be identical. And I'm showing you this proudly, even though all the spectra are different. And the reason I'm showing you this proudly is there are several aspects to that. One is that for all the processing variations that perhaps you can't appreciate, but you may imagine, that are inherent in making structures like this, these are remarkably close together. These are remarkably coincident. The second is that these values of 4,000, 3,800 values for Q are record high values for these structures. And remember, I told you earlier about Qs that were on the order of 18,000, so 4,000 doesn't look too good, but remember the figure of merit is Q times the modal volume, or 1 over the modal volume. So then there's another thing that, in terms of trying to understand and generate this technology, is very important for us, which is that we see a splitting here where we actually expect, for various reasons, that this should be a degenerate mode. That splitting is very important to us because it tells us that we have a very sensitive way of relating exactly the changes in the perfection and the symmetry in the means of in the variations in the processing. We have a way of keying that to what we actually see in the optical spectra.
determined by the mold leaking out to the thickness of the lattice or going into the third dimension?
Well, for us, it's going in the third dimension because of the way we measure it. So there, we need to have some loss, otherwise we can't measure anything. Yes, and so we happen to...
It's determined by, not by the fact that the lattice is finite, but somehow going in different levels.
The short answer to the question is yes. I think it's not a fact that it's finite, because we've done those studies and looked at how many periods we needed. I think there are a number of imperfections associated with the processing and the material that limit the Q. Here's another example that shows with changing lattice constant A, what I showed you earlier, the same structure, we're able to sweep across the spectrum of the quantum dot. So basically what we do by introducing different resonators with different values of A, remember we have that broad spectrum of the quantum dot, is that we're selectively filtering out and picking out different quantum dots in that array. Again, here, different A's, 280 nanometers, 305 nanometers. You can see the shift in wavelength, and actually this is this just is another way of making the point that I made with the earlier view graph, but also it's a way for us to evaluate our computation, our simulation of the structures. Let me talk about this briefly, but with a lot of caveats. I do this just to, in terms of, just to illustrate where we think we are. But don't take these figures too seriously, because there are factors of two or four or otherwise that may change each of these points. What's been plotted here is cavity Q and modal volume, assuming an oscillator strength for the quantum dots of about 11, and we're not sure of the oscillator strength of these dots. And we come up with a factor, you come up with this quality factor, which allows us to say, how close are we to achieving what we think are the conditions for strong coupling, which is represented by this line. So you can see from the way I've plotted the dots is that to the best of our knowledge, which is an estimate, we should be very close. And again, the point is that whether it's the microdiscs or the photonic bandgap resonators, even though the absolute value of Q may not be as high for one structure as another, it's the Q times the modal volume. So this is, I just have a few more view graphs. To suggest that we are indeed, I believe, strong, we're very close to the strong coupling regime. This belies a lot of measurements, a lot of concerns that we still need to deal with. Let me show you another thing along that line, which are measurements of quantum dot lifetimes in different environments. So I show you again the photoluminescence peak of an unprocessed area, the broad peak of the quantum dots, within a microdisc where you see the strong, sharp resonances to the left, and then a plot of lifetimes. So let me just try and translate what this means. You see a lot of different curves. This is lifetime as function of pump power of the laser. And the main thing to see is that there's clearly a variation of the lifetimes of the quantum dots, ranging from about a nanosecond, 1,000 picoseconds, down to maybe tens to 100 picoseconds. There's a whole range. What does this mean? There's a whole range of curves here, which are on the order of a few hundred picoseconds. And then quite obviously, there are these set of data down here with lifetimes on the order of tens to maybe 100 picoseconds. And what these are is a set of measurements where most of these open squares, represent the lifetime of quantum dots as grown, so unprocessed. And what's interesting, but maybe not surprising to note, is that there is a variation in the quantum dot lifetimes. The longer wavelength quantum dots have longer lifetimes in general. That's the trend. So these go from 940 nanometer wavelength to 920 to 903. What we see here, these are the quantum dots that are coupled to the whispering gallery modes. These are the quantum dots that are resonant. And these quantum dots typically have lifetimes, as you can see, less than 100 picoseconds. There are a set of quantum dots that we did in these experiments that are quantum dots that are embedded in the microdisks and yet not resonantly coupled. These show some effect on lifetime, but not as dramatic, maybe a factor of two or so, but not as dramatic an effect as from here to here, which is more than a factor of 10 change in lifetime. The Purcell factor, that change in optical performance and determined by the environment, is defined. One way of defining it is in terms of the lifetime of the emitter in the natural environment as compared to in the confined environment. So we're seeing Purcell factors of greater than 10. So let me just finish up here. Many of you made the points very wisely before about the fact that we have a relatively random, not quite random, a distribution of quantum dots with a dispersion in size. And I've tried to represent it schematically by these kinds of dots here. And we have, here is perhaps one set of whispering gallery modes. So what you see here are these are the antinodes and the nodes of the whispering gallery mode. And the idea is that in order to achieve a strong coupling, what we want is that we have both a spatial over what we so we if in in embedding these quantum dots into that resonator, we basically get something like this, where it's a matter of chance whether we have a coincidence of a particular quantum dot of a particular frequency with the antinode of that mode. Ideally, what we'd like, which you may not be able to see here, is exactly the right quantum dot placed strategically at the antinode of the cavity. And so further improvements, part of that, part of the many things we need to do as further improvements is to optimize that. And in order to achieve that, we have to have some way of either doing this kind of self-assembly where the dots nucleate preferentially at the antinodes of the mode, or that we can deliberately we have a better way of judiciously placing the quantum dots with respect to the symmetry, the geometry of the microdisk. So just to finish up, I've shown you two different kinds of resonators that form a nano or micro environment for quantum dot emitters. We've gotten some very interesting and very gratifying data so far that show that both the emitters that definitely show the interaction, the selectivity that we expect in the interaction between the emitters and the quantum dots. We think we're near to the strong coupling regime, and there are many manifestations, there are many ways that we can proceed from there, but there are a host of issues that we'll have to deal with before we get to that. Thank you. I'm sorry for keeping you so late.
Any questions, comments?
You made the analogy between bound state of the purity of the semiconductor and this resonant.
A defect in the photonic bandgap structure.
Yes. Yeah. So my question is, if there is a full analogy, with impurity you can have a truly bound state, infinite lifetime. But here, I think that eventually the lines get out. So it's a resonant state with a very long lifetime. But still, it's not what do you mean by it? It's not really bound thing, I think. What is the line trying to
I don't want to carry out the analogy to a ridiculous extreme, but I think what isn't shown here is that there are losses. There are other defects in the structure. There are imperfections. So in fact, what exists here is not a single bound state, but a number of possible states, I suspect. So the question here is, yes, in a semiconductor, if you have a single state within the band gap at a particular temperature, it may reside there forever. But you know that electrons can be trapped. If there are other trap states, if they have thermal energy, there are always ways that the electrons can be detrapped. Again, I don't want to answer your question in two ways, which is that what I haven't shown here and which we don't understand yet are there are a number of defects. There's sidewall roughness, there's optical scattering, there may be defects introduced into the material itself. And those may provide, and there may be slight asymmetries. I'm sure there's slight asymmetries. In fact, I think these structures are remarkably robust. And if you want to think of that as placing other states within the gap, and so that the photon can make transitions to that, that's one way of looking at it. The other way of looking at it is the optical signal has some finite spatial extension. This is like a waveguide. It can find just as if you have a quantum well that confines a wave function. If the tail of the wave function can probe an imperfection, another state, then essentially it can tunnel out. So there are all those analogies that might work.
When you say inside that point, these are two-dimensional structures. If you were to make three-dimensional photonic crystals, if you had two photonic bandgaps for all photons, and if you can make it perfect in the sense of all poles being identified, the defects in such a structure would be forever.
I don't think so. I think if you only have dielectric material, it's in principle impossible to have life forever.
Well, I mean, if you talk about some the absorption that comes along with the index of refraction,
I think to have forever in metal, it's not a problem to build a box, an Italian box, and to have their line. But if we have only the electric, I think there is a system, the epsilon is line. It's a positive point. I think so. I don't think I can really prove it now.
Why is it different than a wave?
Because for electron, there is this notion of simple notion of potential well, negative potential. But with line, with dielectric, for instance, I give you a homogeneous dielectric and I allow you now to put a sphere of another material with larger or smaller dielectric quantity. In both cases, there are no bounds there.
This is a block system. No.
Yes.
I know, but there is no analogy. First of all, one thing that for light, there is no analogy of the negative potential. So localization for light, it's always over the barrier. It's always due to this interference, and therefore it mm-hmm. cannot be complete.
I just wondered if you could say a bit more about what new things you expect to happen when you get into the strongly coupled regime.
Well, I want a touch to answer as well. By affecting the lifetime of the emitters, for example, there is the promise of changing the spontaneous emission rate, making optical emitters with basically no threshold involved in order to. So there's a dream of a thresholdless laser. One thing that one guiding motivation that we're, why we are exploring this system is, and there are many steps in between, is to be able to set up a system of emitters that can be controllably connected, addressed externally, but which without deliberate control are basically isolated from the environment, that could, with a lot of work, serve as a prototype model for quantum computation schemes, for example. Attach?
The real question is, how far are you from observing, say, Rabi oscillations of the, I mean, ideally the energy will go from the atomic state to the mode and back, and then when it's in the mode, it can radiate out.
Right.
Is it, could be linked, is it sort of foreseeable that one will be able to observe such beating coming out of this
In principle, yes. I mean, in fact, that's the strong coupling regime. In practice, the way we make this measurement and the fact that we're looking at an optical signal from a largely lossless cavity, but yes, in principle, yes.
Well, because we have seen in the conference a Josephson system that showed maybe 10 Rabi oscillations by Nakamura. Very impressive. No, so I'm wondering what stage would such an experiment get to that stage? I mean, people in atomic cavities, in ordinary cavities, see such things.
Right. I mean, and that's the point of going towards the strong coupling regime, and then understanding. I mean, are we should be very close. Do we see that, or how much better do we have to do? I'm not sure. We may be at the edge, and hopefully, if we're confident that we're in that regime, then we can begin to look.
No more questions. Let's thank Evelyn again.